Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to History 605. Today on the show, Braden and I are going to talk about one of the founding things in South Dakota's history is where the Capitol goes and the Capitol fights, that is plural, the Capitol fights that were part and parcel of late territorial politics and early statehood politics as the fight continued one after another, didn't it, Braden? Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for having me.
As we were going through all the notes in this, and there's scattered articles about this, there's a display in the Capitol building in Pierre about the Capitol fights and the votes that occurred. One thing is central, though, is that where the Capitol was, location seemed to matter, like in all real estate issues, location, location, location.
I think as many people know, having a Capitol in your town is great for the local economy. You know, that was the case with Yankton when it was the territorial capital. A lot of money gets funneled into capital. So it was a really important battle for a lot of different folks to see the longevity of their town.
Well, you mentioned Yankton. That starts off as a territorial capital. You know, it's on the Missouri River. It's across the street in one regard or another from Nebraska, which was on its way to statehood in 1861, 1862. And Congress creates Dakota Territory in 1861. The only lands that are really ready to be inhabited and settled, however, is east of the Missouri, largely due to a treaty with the Yankton Sioux. Yankton then is kind of in the middle of this, so it's on the land ceded by the Yankton Sioux tribe to the United States, and it's on the river, and when riverboat traffic and river is the only way to get around, really, for large groups of people, goods, so forth. Having that proximity to the river is key. No railroads
yet. Yeah, no railroads yet. And a lot of the politics of the Dakota Territory is centered around Easterners, you know, Far Easterners. The first governor of the Dakota Territory is appointed by President Lincoln. William Jayne, one of his family doctors, you know, a close friend of the Lincolns. Yeah.
So he's from Illinois, Jayne is.
Throughout this kind of that 30-year span, a lot of the politics is dominated by Eastern interests, if I can say that. So eventually you get Governor Ordway, if we can fast forward a little bit to the 1880s, and he decides that he wants to move the capital. And we can talk about Ordway in a future episode, but he's not everyone's biggest fan, I think is a fair way to put it. Yeah, there's population growth that's been happening throughout Dakota Territory. And so you're getting real split of a northern Dakota population and a southern Dakota population.
I think one of the contributing factors to that, too, is why the population is kind of along the river and the eastern side of Dakota Territory, along the Missouri River, somewhat along the James River, somewhat along the Sioux River, but central what is today North Dakota and the town of Bismarck gets the railroad. And the other factor that's determining this is that the governors aren't elected by the inhabitants of the territory. They are appointed by the president. As you said, Lincoln appointed Governor Jayne, and Ordway is appointed by the president in 1883. And so he's a creature of Washington politics in many respects. He's a friend or some kind of acquaintance to the president. He's kind of a part of that and represents Washington's interests in the territories. And by the 1880s, with the railroads expanding west and looking for a clear route, say, from Minneapolis to the Pacific Ocean, that kind of northerly route, the curvature of the earth and all of that makes it shorter to go through North Dakota. So Bismarck gets the railroad and Pierre doesn't. The other factor about railroads in South Dakota is that through nearly all of the 1870s and 1880s, the 1868 treaty, Laramie Treaty, created the Great Sioux Reservation, and nearly all of West River, South Dakota, is reservations for the Lakota tribes, the different Teoshpe and the different family groups and tribal affiliations that are having. And so that there's a big hunk of all of Western South Dakota is tribal, and the railroads are from time to time attempting to negotiate with the tribes to build a railroad through there. That doesn't lead to a lot of success. And so if you're going to build a railroad to, say, Pierre, it is kind of a dead end throughout most of the 1880s. That the clarity of having Bismarck and a railway line through Minneapolis to Bismarck and then further west into Montana, the Treaty of 1868 isn't an issue with that regard. And so, yeah, it and Washington politics thinking of building railroads and so forth, that's the key feature. So in 1883, Ordway moves the capital from Yankton, the territorial capital from Yankton to Bismarck, and the folks in Yankton are not happy.
I'd say a little more than not happy, to the point where they decide it's time to start a new state. I mean, yes. They're ready for statehood at that point.
It's almost like a secession movie. There had been talk of a North and South prior to this, but it really energizes. It puts it in high gear to think, okay, mm-hmm. North and South is going to be different now. The federal law dictated you could apply for statehood once you reached a population of 60,000, and Dakota Territory is well past that by 1883. It was just kind of a sense of, okay, now that the federal government has spoken so clearly and moved our capital without our permission, now it's time to be a state and govern our own affairs.
Part of it, too, is you need the consent of the federal government to enter in as a new state, because there are three different attempts before we eventually join in 1889 to become a state. There's they're all convened in Sioux Falls. So you have the 1885, there's a squatter's capital in Huron. You have I believe it's in 1884, almost immediately after the movement of the capital, there's a convention in Sioux Falls.
Yeah.
People are ready to start this new state.
Yeah, it's very much the capital move and other things, the dominant railway interests seeming to govern territorial affairs are really frustrating people. And so folks in Yankton, Sioux Falls, Huron, Watertown, these are the main communities in the state at the time, or in the territory in the time, in Southern Dakota Territory. Sioux Falls, Yankton, Watertown, Huron, Mitchell, they're the primary communities. They're ready to join the Union and leave the territory, I put it that way. And if they have to split up to do so, that's fine. Yeah, so the Constitution they drafted, well, federal law and the federal Constitution require that as states come into the Union, that they have a Republican form of government, that they have that threshold of population of 60,000, which I guess is a number seen to be sufficient to kind of have the resources you need to govern your own affairs, tax base. They draft a constitution in 1883. The makeup of Congress at the time, though, doesn't want two states to come into the Union, or three, if you include Montana, which is also considering statehood at the time, and Wyoming. All seemingly would send Republicans to Congress. And so that's a dead end. In 1883. It's dead end in 1885, and it'll take the presidential and congressional elections at the federal level of 1888 to change the environment in Washington. Republicans come into power, and all of a sudden, lots of Republican senators showing up looks like a great idea. So the Republican in the White House and the Republican Senate and House quickly approve statehood for the former Dakota Territory. In March of 1889, And the Enabling Act is signed in November of 1889. And along the way, then we have to pick a temporary capital for what is now South Dakota. So there's a lot of ballot activity. And looking at the newspapers in 1889, holy smoke. It just seems like, I mean, they've got to do everything, right? They've got to set up who's going to be the senators. They got to sort that out. They got to elect their own state legislature. They got to elect their own governor. And of course, they've got to figure out the temporary capital. So there's a lot to talk about in the papers in Dakota Territory in 1889. And one other thing that the president does, President Harrison, is that he effectively uses the treaty that created the Great Sioux Reservation to disestablish or to diminish, I think is the term they use, a great deal of that Great Sioux Reservation. And it begins to look more like the reservations that you see today based on Harrison's act and Congress's act in 1889. And so when we talked about location, pier, if the Great Sioux Reservation is going to stay the entirety of West River, South Dakota, pier's kind of on the edge. And then there's the sliver on the extreme edge of the Black Hills that's in the state of South Dakota. There's an argument to be made for three different centers of South Dakota, right, Braden?
Right. And it's all, it's all dependent on what your definition of center is. Is it the economic, financial center? Well, you would want Sioux Falls to be the capital. If you're looking for the population center, Huron makes the most sense.
Right.
And then if you're looking geographically, Pier would have been your choice. So you have these different competing groups who are trying to determine, you know, what is center and what's going to work best for the future of South Dakota. And it gets pretty knockdown drag out over this, because as I think they rightly understood, this temporary capital is probably going to become the permanent capital. So if you can win this election, you've got a really good shot in the future of retaining that capital.
Besides the debate about what is central, whether it's economic or population or geographic, what are the other factors that the cities are trying to use to attract votes?
Yeah, part of it too is rail access. You know, Huron tries to promote their excellent railroad access. You know, they talk about having the ability to reach 73 towns without changing trains, whereas Pier can only access 28 towns. It's those different economic factors. They want to talk about accessibility to the capital. All South Dakotans can reach it. There is some idea of the future. You know, Pier talks about the opening of the West and the accessibility to the Black Hills and different areas like that as making them a prime location. So it's not just about central geography, but it's central in they're all arguing about the finance, the geography, the population.
Right.
And some are looking at the current day and some are looking into the future.
And they have to have the facilities too. You're going to have 200 some legislators meet in the House and the Senate. You're going to have, there's certainly an understanding. We'll have to build a proper capital once we get a permanent location sorted out, but even a temporary capital building is going to be necessary. So how are we going to, where are we going to put all these people?
There's a funny story. So Watertown's in the running for the capital placement. And a couple of Watertown, the committee who's in charge of that, start to circulate this idea of putting the capital in Harrison, South Dakota. Harrison isn't a real place at the time.
Yeah.
It's in Hand County. And so Hand County merchants are really excited about this idea of Harrison. So they're circulating the idea of putting the temporary capital in Harrison. And it ends up getting 9 votes during the election for a capital that doesn't exist.
Yeah. Harrison happens to be the president of the United States. That's probably why they picked that name, Harrison. And it's probably just 9 people who love the president. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's kind of bizarre. Yeah, but comment about Watertown is correct. There's more cities besides those central arguments that cities that say, well, we have the amenities, we have the ability, we have the connections to the railroads and so forth. So ultimately, Pier, Huron, Sioux Falls are in the mix, but so are Watertown, Mitchell, Chamberlain, and this fictitious Harrison. One thing that's curious, though, and that once you realize that the Great Sioux Reservation is still effectively West River, all of these selections, you know, Rapid City is not in the running. There's no Black Hills towns. There's Wall, you know, there's no community West River that's in the running. So it's either if you are West River and you're, a Black Hills voter, you're in Deadwood or Custer or Rapid City at the time, you're probably going to vote for Peer. So if access to the Capitol is important to you, maybe Chamberlain, but Peer is easier to get to. So all of the East River communities, you know, just water down their vote, and Peer seemingly would get a lot of support from West River just because it's maybe just a day away instead of 3 days away or something.
Right. And I think that bores itself out in the election results. Peer gets 27,000 votes, roughly. Huron is the next closest with 14,000, and then Watertown has 11,000, Sioux Falls has 11,000, and then Mitchell and Chamberlain lag behind, and Harrison, right. Of course,
and Harrison
leads the caboose. Right.
Didn't break double digits. But
no.
It is interesting. Sioux Falls comes in fourth. So clearly access to the Capitol was driving a lot of this, and whether you think it's access to rail lines that Huron had or that Watertown had. You know, Aberdeen's not in the running. Yankton's not in the running. The folks in Yankton are throwing their support in different ways. One thing I ran across, though, is this fun little missive in the newspapers in the campaign for the Capitol.
Well, and I think part of the Capitol fight that's so interesting is that these different towns are trying to promise land to the people. Yeah, all of it is in a bid to attract the Capitol.
Right.
So they're promising land, they're promising money. It's the same thing that happened when the territorial capital moved to Bismarck. Bismarck had to pony up 120 acres of land and $100,000 to move the Capitol. The same thing is happening on a smaller scale with this new state capital. And so the citizens of these towns have to be pretty bought in and invested.
Right. And the railroads are chipping in land, too. And that's what happens in Pierce.
Mm-hmm.
Railroad gives some land for what becomes the building where the Capitol sits today. We got to have a Capitol, have to have facilities for it, and we don't want to break the bank doing it. So who can make us the best deal? So it's kind of the economic development attitude of our time, you know, put into the understandings and laws and traditions and corporations that existed at their time.
Another note on the 1889 election, you really don't see that much of the population voting for where the Capitol is. The 1890 census for South Dakota has about 320,000 to 340,000 citizens in its population. But you see for this 1889 election, only 75,712 people end up voting. So it's not that many folks. And part of that is access to voting.
Right. No women can vote yet. There's only a few of what the Constitution would refer to as Indians not taxed can vote. They have to be over 21. So there's a lot less access to the ballot. So that's certainly part of the results there that you read off. But a man who is a newspaper editor in Aberdeen in the Capitol election in the October of 1889 publishes a little poem and missive in the Capitol paper. He's all for Huron to be the Capitol. So this is L. Frank Baum. He's the editor of the Aberdeen newspaper, and he certainly has an opinion about where the Capitol should be. This is his poem that he published in his paper. Title is Huron for Capitol. How can any living man, unless his brain is cracked, resolve to put the Capitol on any town sidetracked? No one can fail to understand. Few men should fail to teach it. Our future Capitol should be right where we all can reach it. Consider that while Huron has a road to every section, Peer is with difficulty reached. It lies in such direction that we must all go to Huron and thence to Peer. That's bad. And so let's vote for Huron's election. It's not the best poem, but I think the sentiment is clear. You know, you have to go where we all can reach it. And
Baum comes out with a few better works later on, to his credit.
Yes, he does. The future author of The Wizard of Oz is practicing his craft, I guess, in writing and so forth, and poetry and description and everything. But I think his sentiment is the broader truth he's trying to reach for here. And that Pierre is, as is often said, even today, Pierre's location is centrally isolated. It's not centrally located. So that aspect of things is what he's going for. So they have the election. Pierre wins pretty handily. They scramble. They put together a building to serve as capital for the House, the Senate, the governor, the Supreme Court, the constitutionally elected officers, such as the superintendent of public instruction, the state auditor, the treasurer, and so forth. And the first session then, they have a quick one in November to select their senators. They elect Moody and Pettigrew to be South Dakota's first senators. Another capital fight begins.
Almost immediately.
Almost immediately. In fact, the newspapers, when they talk about the Mitchell paper lamenting their loss, there's a shadow kind of thrown. Well, we fought a good fight. We did things that we are proud of, and we can look forward to this discussion happening again.
Well, and part of establishing the statehood and the temporary capital is that in 1890, South Dakotans have to choose the permanent capital. So Pierre's only won the temporary capital fight.
Yeah.
We talked about how the election happens in October. To prepare for the 1890 session, they have to build the temporary capital in 3 months, less than, I mean, they're getting desks and chairs in the right day session starts.
Yeah. And it's kind clapboard building. And the House is on the second floor, the Senate is on the first floor, and the stomping of feet and the rolling of chairs and the pushing of desks around and so forth, the noise in the Senate chamber from the House above is so maddening that they vote to build, put carpeting down,
right?
But only for the House.
The Senate asks them, can you just take your shoes off? So we can conduct our business. Well, the House would rather put some carpet down, which,
yeah,
fair enough.
Right. It is the West, after all. And
right.
Just everything is new, right?
Immediately, there's this fight for the permanent capital, and it comes down to the same two foes, Huron and Pierre. And this time, it gets to be a little more expensive. I mean, they're ramping up the stakes, if you will. You know, both towns are bonding out their schools and different parks and the municipal systems. I mean, it's starting to get knocked down, drag out, like we said earlier.
They're going deep into debt to attract, to build the facilities that the capital would need. And provide the land and so forth to the state. So it's very much a bidding war. And when is this election?
1890. Yeah, so they had this temporary capital. They have to get the permanent capital. And this is leading to both towns going into some horrific debt. But eventually, Pierre ends up closing it out again. Not without spirited effort from Huron, though.
And when the elections come in... Pierre has 41,000 votes, around that. Huron has 34,000. So, again, this, the geographic center seems to be the thing that drives it, along with probably some spirited politicking going on behind the back rooms and attractions of other things.
Well, one of my favorite little notes from this second capital fight is that, you know, one Pierre store sells or says that they sell over 2,700 yards of ribbon for badges.
Yes.
You know, that just say vote for Pier for capital. You know, something so simple as that. But 2,700 yards. Huron raises almost $250,000 from their bonding efforts, $237,000. Pier almost doubles that. Pier sells $462,000 worth of bonds, which takes them almost 40 years to pay off. I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah, one of these ribbons says Stand Pat for Pier. Progress and prosperity. That Stand Pat was kind of a slogan of the early 20th century Republicans, the conservative Republicans. That was a phrase you would say if you wanted to keep things the way they are, you'd say Stand Pat. So a little bit of the terminology of the time. And then, of course, the bills immediately happen. Despite the election clear, the state legislature bills come to relocate the Capitol in 1895 and 1902, none are passed. But then in 1904, the issue heats up again, and Mitchell now comes to the forefront, rises to the top to take the Capitol slot away from Pier.
And I think part of the reason that Mitchell can still challenge, you know, almost 15 years after the permanent Capitol vote, is because there is no brick and mortar Capitol yet. They're still using that wooden Capitol building. So there, you just get the sense that there's not a permanence to it yet.
Right. Yeah, that would encourage when you start building something of marble and stone, and that is architecturally looking like it's permanent. It just invites more bills to be introduced by members from around the state who want to change things. So, yeah, 1904, there's the third election, and South Dakotans once again choose Pier over Mitchell, 58,000 to 41,000 votes. And then it's finally over. And then the scramble begins to, okay, now let's build a building.
Let's build a building. I just want to make a note on this second Capitol fight, or the third, I guess, at this point.
Yeah.
It's getting intense in its own way. The railroad companies are really starting to get into this fight. And in the last 60 days of the election, they're offering free trips to people who want to go to see Mitchell and Pier. To the point where Pier's getting over 1,000 visitors a day. Mitchell is having all these people flock to the Corn Palace to see John Philip Sousa's band play. It's getting really, really quite intense. But yeah, as you said, Pier ends up pulling it out, and they decide that they need to set about putting something permanent down.
So the state legislature passes the appropriation to build a new Capitol, but of course, they're not going to spend more money than they need to.
Yeah, an immediate snag, right? So in 1904, they passed this. In 1905, they need to decide what kind of material they want to use. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear if we should use out-of-state or in-state material.
Certainly, people have a desire to keep it in-state, but some of the proper material, just construction-wise and so forth, isn't available in the state. If you go out of state, that just leads to more complications, more transportation costs, and you can, if you do it well, accomplish the same objective. And as the engineers would say today, do some value engineering, which basically comes down to cutting costs where you can in order to get the building you need and the time you want. So it does need to be, and certainly with so many buildings in this era built of wood, fire is a huge concern. And so Governor Harried says South Dakota needs a new state house, fireproof, commodious, and in harmony with its progress and prosperity. So now's the time to think about things on a grand scale. And they come up with a design. Where do they get the design?
They were very impressed with Montana's capital, actually. Yeah. So Montana figured out their capital seemingly a little quicker than us. Mm-hmm. And the company, C.E. Bell of Minneapolis, designed that. So South Dakota reached out to that company and got their designs for our capital from that same group. So if you look at and compare on Google Montana's Capitol building and South Dakota's, you'll notice just a striking resemblance. I mean, they're almost sister buildings.
Yeah, very similar. And so the plans come in because they're not created from scratch. The plans come in, we buy copies of that and the interior and so forth, the design, which is really quite striking. White marble staircase, the soaring columns, the ornate plasterwork, the mosaic floors, the stained glass that's used in places. And they come up with a material, though, to save money. They don't want to use marble. It's too expensive. And so the designers and the workers there design this way to make these columns look like marble, but they're actually scagliolia, which is a term I've never seen before.
Right.
Until I started digging into the Capitol a few years ago and come across this term where they figure out a method to take cement embedded in marble dust, dye it in certain ways with a blanket to get a kind of a pattern across.
Yeah, you take yarn. Yeah.
And some yarn and different to kind of create a pattern that looks like marble. Then you polish it up, and it does. I mean, it looks like real marble, but it's significantly cheaper.
Right, almost like a tenth of the cost. It was $100 per column when they were building it versus I think it's like 1,000 or so if they were to do it out of marble. But nowadays, because scagliola is a lost art, it's almost more expensive to find those columns than it is to find marble. Go figure.
Well, and with the Capitol then built and coming into effect, they start construction in 1907. And the work continues. They get it done in a pretty fair pace, though. It's considering the scale of the building that's going on. And by June of 1910, it is dedicated and ready for opening up for the following session that would be coming in January of 1911.
Right. And in 1908 is when they end up setting the cornerstone of the Capitol building, which for people who may or may not know about this, there is a time capsule embedded in that cornerstone that has a variety of objects, coins, there's plans of the Capitol building, photographs, a program of the ceremony, copies of Capitol bills from 1905 and 1907, constitutional debates, South Dakota Code, 1907 annual reports. All of this is jammed in there. I'm sure it's all gone at this point.
Right.
I don't think they knew of acid-free paper.
Yeah, it would be interesting if they how they worked to preserve that for a long term, or if they just stuffed it in there. Because as we've known, time capsules can be tricky. Even concrete can let moisture through, as we know now from working with time capsules. And as a construction engineer will tell you, that certainly happens. And so those things that are in there now, unless they put some type of covering over them or waterproofed it somehow, with maybe tar or some type of thing, although that would be reactive in its own way. So, yeah, I don't know what's the condition of those items in there now are debatable.
Well, and just getting access to those items, I don't know that we'll ever be able to see the inside without the Capitol getting knocked down, I suppose.
The time capsules at the time, that's right. It's kind of a more modern thing now to build a time capsule with the intent of opening it after a certain amount of time. Time capsules like this were put into buildings with the thought that no one will open this up until the building falls down or until the building is torn down. So it was intended to be there for a long time, especially in a building such as this. So a school or some other government buildings might have a lifespan, expected lifespan of maybe 80 to 100 years. But this building is meant to be beyond that. So Yeah, the dedication speech, they have quite a ceremony. General Beadle is still living, and he gives a speech which is fun to read. That speech has been is available to find online. General Beadle's dedication speech, and where he talks about the nature of the Republic, the nature of the movement for statehood, and the progress that the new state is making in providing a Republican form of government to its citizens. Old William Beadle still at it after a long
kind of public service. Incredible that he was still able to see that dedication of the Capitol.
And for a man who provided teacher training workshops, or today we would call those professional development training for teachers riding all over the state on a horse, because there was no north-south railway lines yet when he's going from, say, Yankton to Huron. He's got to go into Minnesota, go north, and then come west. Or he could just ride a horse and get there maybe just as quick. It must have been quite rewarding for him to see the Capitol going up and the universities going up into place. And he was at the time, he was president of what is now Dakota State at the time. So see all this begin to come together must have been very rewarding for him and all the other members who had traversed from territory to statehood and now have a proper, impressive Capitol building.
Right. And the new Capitol really wasn't all that far away from the old Capitol. The old Capitol serves for about 20 years and eventually gets sold off to the Pierce School District, who tears it down and uses that lumber for their new high school.
Yeah.
But only about two blocks away from where the current Capitol sits.
Right. It's two blocks west of there's a couple of law firms there on that corner now. That's where the Capitol was. So at the corner of Capitol Avenue and Euclid. And then the Hughes County Courthouse is across the street from that. So to the west.
But all said and done, I'm just so impressed that they were able to get that new Capitol built for under $1 million.
Right.
It's
$1,910 or $1,907 is $945,000 or something. And then the addition that's put on in the 30s, that's another $250,000 to add that addition onto the Capitol. And at the time, all of state government fit in the Capitol. All the constitutional officers, the governor's office, the Supreme Court are in the Capitol. Still to this day, but, state government's certainly grown. So Department of Social Services, education has moved out. It's got its own buildings. Health is out. Veterans Affairs is across the street, and Soldiers and Sailors building. So that building is put up in the late 30s. And you see the growth of state government kind of beginning in the 1930s. And then, of course, by the 60s and 70s, it's just comparatively astronomical.
And you have to give credit to the citizens of Pierre and their forethought of landing the Capitol when they did. I don't know that anyone could have anticipated that growth and size of state government. And that has brought in a lot of businesses and money to the Pierre economy.
Pierre, Fort Pierre, certainly a lot of ranching that goes on, but the law firms, the state government, the Supreme Court activities that go on, all of the things that conventions and things that happen in Pierre, particularly during the legislative session, brings a lot of people in and out. And the hotels, the Charles Hotel, which is just a block away from the Capitol, and the hotels that exist now more toward the river, and the hotels in Fort Pierre all cater to that activity. So between the rodeo in the summer and the ranching and so forth that goes on, state government and all of the jobs that's provided, certainly the growth in the late 20th century has shaped Pierre differently. But location, 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 we talked about that, but also the timing of it. It's interesting to think, had the Great Sioux Reservation been broken up earlier, maybe West River communities would have grown and Rapid City might have been in the running to be capital. Then Pierre might have lost out to Mitchell or Watertown or
absolutely.
So
sometimes it's just a right place, right time kind of deal.
Yep. Right place, right time, and location, location, location. Mm-hmm. Kind of sums it up. Well, Braden, any other concluding comments about the Capitol fights? I think we enumerated maybe four. Bismarck to Pierre maybe, Pierre again, and then Pierre at last. So
yeah, I think it's maybe a little tough for us to understand how just important it is or was for those people back in that day. And there's a lot of really great articles where you can read more about this. Specifically, the South Dakota History Journal, volume 19, has a wonderful look at statehood and the establishment of the Capitol and talks about these Capitol battles. So if people are interested in that, I'd really recommend they check that out.
And it's worth noting, too, an eminent citizen of the state recently had an op-ed in the Dakota Scout, I believe, about moving the Capitol from Pierre to Sioux Falls or somewhere in the southeast where the population center is. And the response in the op-ed from comments on the people is a lot of pushback. We'll just put it that way.
Well, it just shows you that this is what we cared about back in the 1890s is stuff we still care about today in 2026. I mean, we're really not all that different from the folks that lived back then.
It certainly is easier to participate in, say, if you want to advocate for a bill, to do that these days with video teleconferencing software and the things that have happened in the last 5 years with that. One can testify for or against a bill just based over a Teams chat that the legislature set up for facilitating that. You can do that. The comments didn't mention that. The proximity is still, the physical proximity is still something that matters to people, at least if the comments are any indication. If we had a vote, I don't know. If we had a vote and Sioux Falls wanted to take the Capitol away from Pierre, I think it would lose. Might be close, but I still think it would lose.
I think it would be another knockdown drag out.
If it got on the ballot, it would be a knockdown drag out fight. Well, thanks, Braden, for joining me today on History 605 and talk about all the Capitol fights and why Pierre is the Capitol today and a little bit about the Capitol.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruer for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats or the Republicans or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.